Attention, please, attention, we just came back from the coast. We brought a big director who was California's toast. He came from Germany and Mr. Zucker brought him fame. He went to Hollywood and revolutionized the game. He's the king of all directors. Would you like to meet him now?
Mr. Lubitsch!
Mr. Lubitsch!
Mr. Lubitsch, take a bow!
Welcome to Season 5 of How Would Lubitsch Do It, a podcast in which we discuss the works of director Ernst Lubitsch, one film at a time. It's our final season, and much has changed. Lubitsch is production head of Paramount, though not for long. The Production Code Administration is enforcing the Hays Code with an iron fist. And much worse, the National Socialist German Workers' Party is ruling Germany with a significantly heavier iron fist. Over the next 10 years, we'll experience another world war, the height of classical Hollywood's power and influence, and the death of our show's namesake. We will also be covering the work of a number of his disciples, including Preston Sturges, Billy Wilder, and Otto Preminger. In fact, there is so much to cover that we split this final season into two halves. We'll take a little break midway through before finishing things off in the summer. Presently, we have an exciting guest, Scott Eyman, author of Laughter in Paradise. Come visit ErnstCast.com if you'd like show notes, resources as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing, a link to our Discord, or just to say hi. Hello, everyone. We're here with Scott Eyman. Those of you who are really avid followers of this podcast, I have probably dropped your name more than anyone whose name does not end with Lubitsch on this show, because your book on Ernst Lubitsch, Laughter in Paradise, has been an incredible resource for this whole enterprise. I have about 400 pages of notes at this point, and I'd say a good third of that is me just like taking notes from your book. This whole show and me owe you an immense debt of gratitude. I'd like to first start by asking, as an author of numerous biographies of figures like Lubitsch, you've recently released a biography on Chaplin. I've actually read your Ford book. I've read your John Wayne. I've read your Cary Grant book. Lubitsch is probably one of the more obscure figures you've covered. What got you into Lubitsch? What moved you to spend years of your life writing a biography on this man?
Well, I always loved his films. Everything I write comes from professional respect and or awe. I've never written a book about someone whose work I didn't respect. In terms of Lubitsch, I came to him through the sound films, some of the musicals, the early musicals, although my favorite of his musicals is The Merry Widow, by far.
We're in agreement on that.
Yeah. And then after that, he got off musicals.
Yeah.
Because I think he felt maybe he couldn't do any better than that as well. But my supreme favorite of Lubitsch's pictures is The Shop Around the Corner. If you can have a shattering masterpiece about a happy love affair, that's it.
Mm.
Because it skirts catastrophe and disaster and estrangement almost throughout the picture. I just fell in love with him after I saw The Shop Around the Corner. And then I backtracked and started watching other movies. And then when I was doing my book on Mary Pickford, I trekked to the Museum of Modern Art to watch Rosita, because they were the only archive in America that had a rare Rosita. It made a little money. It was not a flop commercially. But nobody seemed to like it. It fell between two stools. It wasn't what Pickford's fans expected, and it wasn't what Lubitsch's fans expected. It was one of those breech birth movies. And I sat there watching it on a Steenbeck, on a 16mm print, and I thought, this isn't bad. What's the problem here? You know, really? I mean, it's not great, but it's not terrible. It's not bad. It certainly doesn't deserve its pig in a poke reputation. And I started thinking about Lubitsch in the overall point of view, his place in the American film firmament, his place in the German film firmament, and why, in spite of the fact he was never a particularly commercial filmmaker, the number of films he made that showed a profit, any kind of considerable profit, are fairly small. But he always worked because he was so highly respected within the industry. And he was careful with budgets, and he managed upwards very well, and actors liked him, because he was a frustrated actor himself and they found it deeply entertaining. And I just thought he'd be an interesting personality. So I was Kevin Brownlow's a friend of mine. And I had two or three ideas for a follow-up to the Pickford book. And I said, there's this, and there's Lubitsch. And Kevin kind of looked off into the distance and he said, do Lubitsch. Lubitsch will be fun. And that turned out to be absolutely the case. Lubitsch was fun because Lubitsch's films were an authentic projection of his personality, which is not always the case with an artist. sometimes their art is far more of a performance than they're capable of giving in real life. But Lubitsch's films are indeed a projection of who he was as a human being. So if you like Lubitsch's films, then you would adore spending 3 years of your life talking to people about Lubitsch, especially people who knew him.
Yeah, he kind of manages to operate on a different wavelength than maybe we've been trained to think of these kind of Hollywood greats, right? Where you read a book about Ford or Hitchcock, and those are two men who are in many ways defined by their kind of inner turmoil and darkness. Mm-hmm. Part of why I find him fascinating personally is because of those inner contradictions that kind of defined his life. But Lubitsch, you mentioned this in the preface to your book, that Lubitsch was, you know, someone of good humor, a considerably kind of lighter prospect. You didn't have to kind of trudge through the darkness for years.
No, he looked for the brightness in life as much as possible and generally found it. Although his domestic life was not what he wanted, I'm sure, he tried. He gave it his best shot. And there's always that gap between the life you put on the screen and the life you're capable of creating off screen. You know, there's that gap that you find. But Lubitsch was a charming personality off screen as well as on screen. And not all directors are, you know. some work very hard at being not charming. Hitchcock could turn on the charm because he had a television show and because he liked to seduce newspaper critics into giving of the best reviews he could get, but not everybody found him a day at the beach, you know? Ford, we all know about Ford's roughness and occasionally a sadistic sense of humor. And there's a lot of other directors you could also name. But Lubitsch worked with charm and with energy on a film set and basically an act of seduction, getting his actors to give them what he needed to make his movie work, you know? And not every actor was necessarily predisposed in that regard. Everybody talked about what a grump Maurice Chevalier was as a human being. Mm-hmm. But when you turned the camera on, there was the smile. There was that ooh la la French sensibility. There was Maurice Chevalier. And when the camera turned off, he was a gloomy Gus again. But Lubitsch wasn't like that. Lubitsch off screen was what you'd imagine him to be from looking at his movies. And I found that very attractive.
It's interesting to compare him to von Sternberg. Lubitsch and him kind of butted heads in this mid-30s period. Von Sternberg, in many ways, people have posited, including in your book, somewhat jealous of Lubitsch's people skills.
Yeah.
He lacked them. And I mean, clearly, von Sternberg, I think, is an incredible filmmaker. But, you know, we see what happened with his career, right? It fell apart largely because he burned every bridge he had.
He was not a gemütlich personality. He was a brooder. He could be cruel. I spoke to probably half a dozen people that worked with Sternberg. None of them liked him as a person. They admired him as a director, as an artist, in terms of the images he could create. But, I mean, Cesar Romero would, and Cesar Romero was a mild-mannered man, but he grew rather corrosive about Sternberg because Sternberg made him do about 20 takes rushing down a flight of steps in Cuban heels. And the steps are covered with confetti, and this is in The Devil is a Woman. And he just made him do it over and over again. And there wasn't any difference between the takes. And to his dying day, Cesar Romero believed that Sternberg was trying to make him fall. And that was not a typical Sternberg. He had a lot of issues, shall we say. A lot of issues. And he took to command a little too enthusiastically. And as a result, although no one could question his gift and his talent, and he made some great films, but he had a stunted career because of his personality and because of the fact that people didn't really want to work with him after a certain point. And Lubitsch was, of course, the complete opposite. People wanted to work with him, even if he had a couple of flops in a row, because he was still Lubitsch and because he was a pleasure to be around.
There was an interesting comparison between that, the 20 takes there, and Lubitsch's way of dealing with actors who didn't necessarily want to do a scene, where I believe it was in Forbidden Paradise, Paul Negri didn't want to run down a flight of stairs in a certain dress, and because she thought she would trip on it. And Lubitsch, you know, dealt with that by putting on the dress, running down the flight of stairs and going, see, essentially. And so I think that's a telling difference between him and someone like von Sternberg.
Yes, yes.
And I think this is a good bridge into kind of talking about the context of this, because a big thing has happened since we last left Lubitsch, which was our Merry Widow episode from last season, which is in February 1935, Ernst Lubitsch was named the production head of Paramount. And this came with it a lot of responsibilities.
To say the least, yes. Because Paramount was climbing out of what would now be considered, you know, Chapter 11. Because of the Depression and everything. I believe it was 1932 when they had to go into receivership. And they kept operating, they kept making movies. And as the 30s wore on, the economy gradually improved and people started going to the movies again. By 1938 or 39, they're actually in decent shape. But Lubitsch was a caretaker choice I think he was like the last guy in the room. I don't think he went for it. I think they tapped him because probably of his organizational skills, because he was a very organized filmmaker. His movies were always made on time and on budget. And he was respected for that, which is one reason he could sustain a career for his entire short lifespan. I think he was 55 or 56 when he died. But even when he wasn't particularly making hits, the movies cost what they were supposed to cost. He didn't go 20% or 25% over budget. The film was made on time. And that earned him respect from the guys in the front office. So still, hiring a world-class, not terribly commercial director to run a movie studio might not be the way you want to go. You want to hire Steven Spielberg to run a movie studio. You don't really want to hire David Lynch to run a movie studio, you know? By hiring Lubitsch, they were hiring, you know, someone who was closer to David Lynch than to Steven Spielberg. He was there for a year. They said, I suspect it was a caretaker job until they could get their finances completely firmed up. The most telling thing I was ever told about Lubitsch as the studio head came from Mae West. I was interviewing Mae West. Yes, I'm old enough to have interviewed Mae West at her apartment on North Rossbourne, and in that wonderful old building that's still there, and a pearly cocoon of an apartment. And I asked her about Lubitsch. Now, Mae West was kind of Norma Desmond-y. She had her version of reality, which did not always correspond to necessarily historic fact. But I have no reason to doubt what she said. She said, Lubitsch had a bad habit during his year as production head at Paramount of cherry picking sequences in all the pictures that were shooting. He would pick the best scene in every script that was going into production and go on the set and direct that one good scene, or ask the director if he could direct that one good scene. And he did the same thing with Mae West. I don't remember if it was Belle of the 90s or Go West, Young Man. It was one of the pictures towards the tail end of her Paramount period. But he wanted to direct this scene from her picture. And she said, well, why don't you direct the whole picture? She said, why direct one scene? She didn't understand why he was doing that. And I just think he wanted to keep his hand in, and he wanted to get out of the office. You know, he wanted mm-hmm. to get on the set where the lights were, where the actors were, where he could, you know, create a performance, create a vibe. And she objected to his, what she called his habit of doing that. And he backed off. He backed off, according to her. But then Mae West was never a team player. But that was the most telling anecdote that I've heard about Lubitsch's period as a studio head, that he really kind of tried to keep one foot in the actual directing by usurping a good scene here, a good scene there, just to keep his hand in.
He definitely had a history with 1 Hour With You, for example, was a good example where he tried to keep his hands off, but couldn't help himself overtaking Cukor.
Yeah. And Cukor's a very good director. I have no criticism to make of George Cukor, but he's not Lubitsch. He doesn't have the lilt that Lubitsch had.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Lubitsch looked at the rushes and said, I can do this better. And Cukor at that point was just beginning his career and didn't have any leverage at all at Paramount to fight it. So Lubitsch basically just took the picture over. And I don't think Cukor ever really got over it. And Cukor basically tried not to slag people in print when he would give interviews. You know, he tried to be as gentle as he could be because he was basically a gentle personality. But he wasn't terribly enthusiastic about Lubitsch. Because I think he felt that Lubitsch had stolen his thunder and probably hurt his career.
Yeah.
Until he managed to make Little Women a year later and that picked up some momentum again.
I mean, I definitely don't blame Cukor in this situation. That was...
No.
Even if it resulted in probably a better film. It is interesting. I mean, as a side note, I've just been delving into Love Me Tonight because we did an episode on that last season and trying to kind of suss out... That was at one point going to be a Lubitsch project.
Yeah, it's quite obvious. Yeah.
Yeah, all the DNA is there, but yet the Reuben McWilliam touch, such as it is also so evident. I mean, his pants on fire showiness, but the Lubitsch touch is totally gone, and it just feels like there's a void at the heart of that movie. And again, I love that movie, actually. I feel like I'm slagging it, but I love Me Tonight. But there's a void in the heart of it that is full in The Merry Widow.
Well, the thing about Lubitsch is, basically beginning with the films he was making at Warner Brothers in the 20s, which I'm not insane about, but beginning with the sound films and continuing all the way through to the end of his life, what his movies are basically about is the process by which lust becomes love.
Mm.
And he doesn't slag either portion of the equation. Lust is important and love is important, but he always starts with lust. He always starts with the desire to get the girl into the sack. And I find that a fascinating way of looking at a love story. I'm surprised more people don't do it, actually. I mean, it's kind of a template. And I mean, you can see it in movies like, you know, When Harry Met Sally. But then that's about friendship that becomes love. And I don't think Lubitsch valued friendship as much as he valued lust. At least not when he's making a movie.
There's a quote I pulled from his niece, Ruth, that he wanted to keep the family in New York, not in Hollywood. And you describe it in the book as he loved his family, but from a distance.
Yeah.
You know, that was just his way of dealing with people personally, is that he had a hard time letting people in, maybe?
Yeah, I think he found his family in Hollywood, you know? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have that dichotomy where you grow up with a group of people and you love them and all that, but you don't have that much to talk about with them. Mm-hmm. Do you find your tribe? You don't always find your tribe within your family. You find your tribe within your work, within your passion, with what you're drawn to, that you would do for free. And if you can get somebody to pay you to do it, that's even better. And Lubitsch would have been, he wasn't a very good actor, in all honesty. I think he would have directed for a lot less money than he was making, just for the sheer pleasure of shaping performance, of working with the crew, of working with actors. He liked actors. That's unusual. Not a lot of directors really, really like actors. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is he'd been an actor and he wasn't a very good actor. So he knew how hard it is to be a good actor and to have a personality and to be able to project that personality through the lens onto the film so that the audience can understand who you are beneath the character you're playing, you know, get a sense of who you are as a human being. And I think he had a almost fan's regard for actors who could do that, you know, like Chevalier, like, well, there's a lot of, he always got great performances, even if he didn't have a great cast. You know, I don't think the picture he made with Merle Oberon and Burgess Meredith is very good. I think it's one of his lesser pictures.
It's the That Uncertain Feeling, right? Yeah.
But he got a good performance out of Merle Oberon, which not too many people did. And when he had actors with whom he was simpatico, like Carol Lombard and Jack Benny, in To Be or Not to Be, well, sky's the limit.
Actors seem to overwhelmingly like him, but the actors that bristled at his direction, I think, are very interesting because you have someone like Adolphe Manjou, who, despite, I think, being friends with Lubitsch, did speak more highly of Chaplin. He compared Lubitsch unfavorably to him in the direction department, saying essentially all he wanted me to do was to copy what he did when he notoriously, he would just basically run through each role in the scene and say, right, do that. And actors could interpret that as they would. Jack Benny loved that. And then someone like Garbo, who also bristled at that. But what I find interesting about that is you can absolutely see that method that they bristled at and other actors loved in the film, because you know how people talk about various modern directors like this, like they say you can hear Wes Anderson in his dialogue, you can hear Tarantino in his dialogue,
sure,
etc.
Sure.
Having now heard Lubitsch talk in, you know, English and German, I can really hear him in all of his characters. You put like someone like Margaret Sullivan in Shop Around the Corner, her cadence is different in that film than it is in, for example, The Mortal Storm. And I find that fascinating, where in a very specific way, even his accent in a weird way comes through in his films in a way that I don't see with other directors.
I think it's because of the beat.
Mm.
I think he would establish a rhythm, and a sensitive actor could interpret his rhythm, his sense of timing through themselves without losing what Lubitsch wanted. That's why he loved Benny, of course, because there was no greater timer of comedy than Jack Benny. I think he's still a comedy god as far as I'm concerned. And with an actress like Margaret Sullivan, she becomes beautiful as the film goes along. It's not the photography. She's photographed the same way at the beginning of the picture as she is at the end. Not that he's suddenly going with von Sternberg lighting and soft focus. He's not. It's the way he softens her rhythm as an actress as the film goes along. And that scene by her bedside at the end of the picture where Stuart kind of declares his love surreptitiously. It's just enchanting, but it's played down. It's played to a whisper. It's suggestive. It's not demonstrative. It's not projected at all. It's really real life. And it's played for the terrible possibility of pain, too. Because Lubitsch knew all about pain. He knew all about romantic pain.
As funnier because it acknowledges the pain. That scene, it plays is terrifically funny to me, especially there's this one close-up of Jimmy Stewart where you can tell he can't contain himself in that scene. And yeah, it, because of the context of all the sadness and especially the possibility of tragedy here. I mean, I think the scene comes in the wake of Mr. Mottochak's attempted suicide too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's this melancholy to it. Same thing in To Be or Not to Be, right? Where the last third is one of the funniest stretches of any film I can imagine. Partially because there's 20 minutes before that, there's not a laugh and you just feel sick to your stomach.
Well, yeah, To Be or Not to Be is a very daring film. Because on the one hand, it's a satire of theatrical egocentricity, which is always good. Hence Jack Benny, whose comic character was essentially that of a pompous fool, you know, who doesn't understand how people really see him. So, of course, he's perfect casting for the part of Joseph Turra, that great, great Polish actor.
By the way, I believe her husband is that great, great Polish actor, Joseph Turra. Of course, you've heard of him.
No, I haven't.
Oh.
But to be able to get the same kind of vulnerability and faceted characterization out of Jimmy Stewart from Indiana, Pennsylvania. And there is nothing Hungarian about Jimmy Stewart at all. He's small town America. And every time he opens his mouth, you know he's small town America. But by God, you buy him. You end up absolutely buying the character because his decency as a human being comes through. Always. Jimmy Stewart's decency always comes through. That's what is stock in trade was, except it wasn't a stock in trade. It's who he actually was as a human being.
In all the other areas of my cinematic life, I'm a bit of a maximalist. You know, I think my favorite period in Lubitsch's films is the upcoming period where he really scales down in certain ways, especially tonal. And it's kind of what we're describing, this tenderness that is opened up that allows Jimmy Stewart to be Hungarian, basically, right? I don't know if Jimmy Stewart could have done the same thing in the context of A Merry Widow, where it's just this flamboyant, active movie. I'm going to steal a phrase from William Paul. The title of this period of his career is Out of Step. You had a growing trend towards the screwball, the fast talking, you know, the His Girl Fridays of the world, The Awful Truth. And away from stuff like what Lubitsch was doing in Angel, To Be or Not to Be, and Shop Around the Corner, and especially Clooney Brown, where it almost feels like someone sitting very still for 2 hours and telling you the story in the softest possible voice. What changed in the 3 years between The Merry Widow and Angel?
I don't like Angel very much. It's probably my least favorite of Lubitsch's later pictures. And I'm not sure why. Maybe it's Melvin Douglas, who's a wonderful actor, but there's nothing erotic about Melvin Douglas. There just isn't. I think I call him Uncle Mel in the book. I think Lubitsch was on the verge of going stale. Angel and Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, I don't find great pictures. I mean, Bluebeard's Eighth Wife has moments, of course, and it's the picture that introduced him to Billy Wilder and introduced Billy Wilder to Lubitsch, which changed Billy Wilder's life forever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think either one is successful. I think he was getting stale. I think he'd been at Paramount too long. And I think something happened after he tried to go back to directing, after the studio had year, after he got kicked back downstairs to finish out his contract directing pictures at Paramount. I'm not sure what it was. But there's a real fall off between The Merry Widow at MGM in 1934, and then he gets tapped at Paramount, and then the couple of pictures he makes at Paramount after the year he's studio had. It's almost as if he'd forgotten what made his earlier pictures work so well. There's some element that's missing in both of those pictures. I mean, the setup for Bluebeard's Eighth Wife is delightful. You know, he only buys bottoms and she only buys the tops or the pajama thing. That's delightful. I always get a sense of drift after that. And I never asked Wilder about it. I talked to Wilder a long time about Lubitsch, and Wilder would talk all day about Lubitsch because it was Lubitsch was his father figure, really, literally his father figure, spiritually, creatively, emotionally. But I never asked him about why Bluebeard's Eighth Wife didn't quite gel.
Mm-hmm.
We did talk about Ninotchka. But then Lubitsch tries to set up Shop Around the Corner independently and has a little trouble. Because in 1939, there wasn't a lot of independent production and he needed a couple stars. And then he got lucky and Metro wanted him to do the Garbo picture, Ninotchka. And so he was able to finesse bringing a Shop Around the Corner back in with him to MGM so he could get a twofer out of it. He could do Ninotchka for MGM and he could do Shop Around the Corner for himself. And he was back on track. But, you know, where directors go wrong is not always obvious. Sometimes it's obvious. And sometimes it's like, was their marriage breaking up? Were they having trouble? Were they having a child with an alcohol problem? You don't know what's going on in their life. Mm. And sometimes you just misjudge your script. You think the script is okay, and maybe you can elevate it a half a stop from, say, a B minus to a B plus, but it turns out you can't. It turns out you can't for one reason or another. Everybody makes, even great directors sometimes make mistakes in judgment. It's part of being human. It's part of being human.
This part of what I find so impressive about Ninotchka, because that's his one for them that he did to Shop Around
Absolutely.
The Corner.
Absolutely. And I'm sure he liked the idea of working with Garbo is very enticing, especially given the premise where she's basically doing a satire of her own screen character for most of the picture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then she melts. And I'm sure that was what intrigued him about it. Not just directing a straight Garbo thing where she walks through it like the Sphinx, but he did bring something magical to Ninotchka. And I think it's a better movie than probably it would have looked on paper. I think he got more than it was in the script, actually, because of how he handles her.
Mm-hmm.
Although I wish Cary Grant had agreed to do the picture.
I'm much more positive on Melvin Douglas than most, but even I can't deny that the mind reels to think of what Cary Grant would have done with that.
He's more erotic. He's simply sexier. Melvin Douglas is not particularly a sexy actor, which is why he has such a great third act as a character actor, as an older character actor, because he could mature very easily from his leading man phase. I've always thought that's the only really flaw in the picture. She overwhelms her leading man.
If I had to pick a single performance in any Lubitsch film that I would say is maybe the most accomplished, it might be Garbo in that movie, even though she didn't seem to particularly get on with Lubitsch.
Well, yeah, but she didn't like to act.
Yeah, that's true, man. Yeah.
And she did it grudgingly. She quit as soon as she could get out. It just took one flop and she was gone and she had zero interest in ever coming back. That shows you that she's not really an actress as we think of an actress. Because most actors, you have to shoot them to get them to stop. You got to stake them through the heart. They'll show up for a grocery store opening when they're 85 years old. It was not her thing. It was not her passion. I don't know what her passion was, but it wasn't acting. Acting was something she did almost grudgingly because she had a family to support, because it was expected of her, because she'd signed a contract, because it was a lot of money and she liked money and she didn't want to be poor. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
She never copped to it. She never really told us why she made movies for, what, 13 years, 14 years, 15 years tops. And then walked away. But you got to respect that integrity.
Oh, yeah.
Or strength of will, if not integrity.
One of the very few cases where someone retires quite young and they actually stick with it.
And they stick with it. They walk away. Yeah, yeah, exactly. If only Willie Mays had done that.
So the next kind of big element we haven't really broached here about this period in Lubitsch's life is the terribly interesting political situation he found himself in at this point. A lot of different elements come in here, right? And I think a lot of it has to do with his kind of identity as an American, as a German, and as a Jewish man. He loses his German citizenship. He gets stripped by the Nazis, specifically in 1935, mm-hmm. and becomes an American citizen exactly 1 year later, almost to the day, in 1936. He was deemed dangerous to the German state. At this point, I mean, he was kind of well known for kind of embracing the American way of life, at least the Hollywood way of life. What impact did his loss of German citizenship have on him, if any? And what does that kind of say about how he saw himself as a German and an American?
He was fairly typical amongst the German emigres of his generation. Dietrich, Wilder, Lubitsch, there were a dozen others, Lang. I knew Lang very well, and he despised Germany, and he despised Germans for what they had allowed to happen to themselves, for acquiescing to what they did. He had zero interest. That's why he lived in America the rest of his life. He could have gone back to Germany. Dietrich could have gone back to Germany. They would have been happy to have her after the war in the 50s or 60s. Lang could have gone back to Germany. They would have been happy to have him. All those men and women were so alienated by, well, for one thing, a lot of them were Jewish. And Hitler either wanted to murder them or their relatives. And if he didn't, it wasn't because he didn't try. They took him at his word. And they took Germans at their implied word that the Germans approved. So there was simply a great deal of animosity on the part of the German emigres to Hollywood. So they became devoted Americans. Even though Dietrich spent the end of her life in Paris, that was for economic reasons as much as anything. If she'd been able to, I suspect she would have stayed in New York or Hollywood if she could have. But they were completely alienated from their native country. Billy Wilder stayed in Hollywood happily for the rest of his life, too. So I just think if you didn't go through the war, if you didn't go through the anti-Semitism, if you didn't go through having relatives disappear into the camps and never come out again, you can't understand their motivation for being so happy in Hollywood.
In the case of Wilder, I mean, I recently watched a Foreign Affair, which it's a fascinating film. I mean, it's him working through his feelings about his native country
exactly.
and his anger.
Exactly, exactly. And Dietrich's willingness to play the part of a, what would you call her? Pragmatist, an amoral pragmatist, shall we say?
She's unrepentant, yeah.
No, she did what she had to do to survive.
Yeah.
And she's not particularly apologetic about it. And she thinks the Americans are naive. I don't doubt that because Wilder had a foot in both camps by that time. He'd been here a while. And he understood the Germans on the cellular level, even though he was essentially Austrian. And he understood the Americans on the cellular level by that time. And I think it's a very accurate portrayal of both cultures clashing, you know, which is why it's so fascinating. I think Lubitsch would have loved Foreign Affair.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have made it himself. It's too harsh, I think, for Lubitsch to make. But I think he would have really enjoyed the picture.
You know, in this period, Lubitsch immediately he might not have known this at the time, because how could you know what was about to happen? But essentially rescues some of his family members from Germany, pays for the emigration of his sister and his niece and her husband at the time. And so he clearly knew, he was aware that things were rapidly deteriorating and getting dangerous. But at the same time, he declined to participate in the Anti-Nazi League, which was an organization dedicated to, the title's obvious. Why was that? What was his motivation there? Was it the association of that with perhaps communism, or?
I suspect he was a little leery of getting involved in politics, perhaps because he may not have had a full understanding of American politics and he didn't want to stub his toe, because at that point he needed America more than America needed him, mm-hmm. You know, practically speaking. He was here. He'd moved his family here. He had his daughter here. He didn't want to risk anything. And there were a lot of very left-wing people in the Anti-Nazi League. And I believe it was actually a front for the American Communist Party. That said, there were a lot of people in the Anti-Nazi League who weren't communists, but he may not have been too sure. A lot of his charitable work came in the fund that he and Paul Koner put together.
The European Film Fund, yeah.
That was a huge contribution to the emigre experience in Hollywood, you know, where all the emigres would tithe 1% of their salaries into a fund, and then Koner would disperse it to actors and writers and directors, and I think some cameramen as well, who got out of Germany and came over here and tried to find work when there was no work. And it made a huge difference. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money. Sometimes it would be $50 a week or $40 a week, but it was enough to not starve. And they also, which was even more important, frankly, they put the arm on all the studios to, even if they had no work, just hire people and use them as extras in crowd scene and pay them some kind of wage so that they won't starve to death, so they could have an apartment someplace, you know, off Hollywood Boulevard. And the studios complied. Each studio picked up dozens of people on, you know, very small contracts, but a gig is a gig, especially if you don't know the language or you're trying to learn the language. So between them, Lubitsch and Koner really, really did yeoman work. And they got very little notice for it because they didn't want notice for it. This is what they were doing for their countrymen. And they've both been very successful here in America. And they wanted, I think, to spread as much success around as they could.
And at this point, Lubitsch, he actually visited Russia at this point, too, as told in your book. He was disaffected. That's the word I'm trying to find. Yeah. He was rather disaffected with the USSR.
Well, I think he would have gone because he was curious, You know, as so many people were. Although Chaplin never went to the U.S. He always refused to go.
Mm.
And they accused him of being a communist, you know, for 30 years. But he never went to Russia. He had no interest in going to Russia. I think he was just curious. And it was that trip he made. What was it? It was in the mid-30s. Hitler's already in Germany. I mean, I'm imposing this on him. But he might not have seen really much difference between Stalin and Hitler. You know, one strong man of the left as opposed to a strong man of the right. And they're both have persecutorial temperaments. What's the difference?
This is going to become, I think, very relevant throughout this run of movies we're going to cover. Because what I think is maybe novel, or at least more foregrounded in this period of Lubitsch's career, is the political angle of his films. You know, we have a succession of films here like Ninotchka, To Be or Not to Be. I think even Clooney Brown you could put in this. Films that almost critique, deconstruct, or just deal with the implications of these various ways of ordering society, usually in the context of them being an impediment to, you know, romantic happiness in the protagonists.
I think he was an intensely political filmmaker, not in terms of Democrat versus Republican. But I mean, Trouble in Paradise is extremely political. The idea of the criminal being ostracized by conventional society when conventionalist society steals more money than the criminal could ever hope to steal, which is a subtext that plays a part in the plot. So I think of him as an extremely political filmmaker, sexually political, emotionally political, and politically political. But he didn't deal with conventional left-right. Now, he wasn't interested in left-right, I don't. He was interested in how people actually live their lives compared to how they pretend to live their lives.
I think you make a very good argument for that, that I have a too narrow of a definition of political in this case, and I think that's probably true. I think Ninotchka is an interesting flashpoint in this, because that's such a clear case, too, of that film. I see a lot of kind of attempts to deconstruct it as, is this anti-communist, is this pro-communist, and I find all that fairly tiresome. That film is, if anything, a statement about what you're saying, the things people pretend to believe, versus what's actually important to them, right? In this case, Melvin and Garbo fulfilling their, you know, wish to be in a romantic relationship with each other requires them to, one, to navigate the society that doesn't want that to happen, but two, to learn forbearance within themselves, to tolerate one another's political and philosophical viewpoints. And that seems to trump, you know, the question of whether or not Ninotchka is a devoted communist.
Exactly, because we know her socialistic instincts can be traduced by a beautiful hat, which actually is kind of a silly hat. It's not a gorgeous hat, but that's not the point. She responds, she feels the hat is beautiful, therefore it becomes beautiful.
That's a very good way of putting it. Her first reaction to it is no society that would produce such a hat has any chance of surviving something like that.
Exactly.
How can such a civilization survive which permits their women to put things like that on their heads? Won't be long now, comrades.
The film doesn't exactly refute her.
No, it doesn't. He has it both ways, actually. But I've always thought that was a remarkably smart of Louis B. Mayer to bring Lubitsch over and to let him make the movie with his crew, to bring over Billy Wilder and Brackett. Well, I think Walter Reich might actually have still been at Metro by that time on his own. But they let Lubitsch make a Lubitsch movie without trying to impose the 1939 Metro style on him. But then Thalberg had done the same thing when Thalberg produced The Merry Widow a few years earlier. But everybody figured the business was, you know, the MGM was going to fall apart without Thalberg. And it's not really true. I mean, MGM continued successfully for many, many more years without Thalberg. Mayer was not the gross vulgarian he's often portrayed as.
This is a tangent, but I like tangents. MGM is the one studio that I often hear criticisms of with regards to Lubitsch, in that one common criticism I hear of Student Prince and Old Heidelberg, which is a film I love.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful film.
Is that it feels more like an MGM film than a Lubitsch film. And I don't really agree with that. But it is interesting how one can view something like that as, you know, a naturist statement by a studio, you know, Thalberg and the MGM folks, or of Lubitsch. And I mean, to me, I just love the film no matter what. I just think it's soaring and it makes me happy and sad at the same time.
I like the film, too. I think it's a very good film. I don't think he would have gone to MGM to make Shop Around the Corner if he thought they were going to negatively impact the film. I don't think it was contractual. I don't think there was anything in his contract that said you'll have final cut. No. He knew by that time he would, allowing for budget and, you know, scheduling and all that, they knew he would get the film done on time and at the cost they wanted. And in turn, they'd let him leave him alone. There was a mutual respect. You didn't hire Lubitsch to make a movie that Robert Z. Leonard could have directed.
Anyway, and they were rewarded by, you know, Shop Around the Corner was a surprisingly profitable film.
It was by
Lubitsch.
I suspect that it made more money than Ninotchka did, actually.
It did, yeah.
Yeah, because they lost the European market by the time Ninotchka came out. France and Germany were gone, which was a big part of her box office, Europe. So all they had was England, and it wasn't enough. So they eked out, I think, $100,000 profit on Ninotchka. Man, Mayer said something like, any Andy Hardy movie makes a lot more money than that. So he had his eye on the bottom line. But that was a function of much of Europe being already occupied by the fascists. It wouldn't allow American films to be shown.
The last of the kind of distinct, not sequitur friendly subjects I want to address today while we're updating all our audience on the life and times of Ernst is his romantic life, where he has, I mean, if we all remember from around the time of the Love Parade, he and his previous wife, Lenny, had a falling out because of Lenny running away with Hans.
She was having an affair with Hans Kralik, his favorite screenwriter that, yes.
Yeah.
And he was, I guess, blindsided by it. Unlike a husband in a Lubitsch movie, he divorced her. Left her flat, which is the difference between real life and art. People react as human beings, not necessarily as characters in a movie. He could deal with adultery very gracefully in his work, but dealing with it in his life was another issue entirely. That's an awesome hit.
He met Vivian Gay in 1935. They were married by July. It would seem that his relationship issues continued.
Well, I never met her. All I can tell you is that every single one of Lubitsch's friends that I interviewed disliked her. Intensely. They thought that she didn't love him, and she alienated all of his friends. Lubitsch had an interesting circle of friends. There was the German colony, of course, but there were also people like William Wyler was German, or from Alsace-Lorraine, actually. But Wyler lived down the street from Lubitsch in Bel Air, and they were part of each other's social circle, you know, and Preminger, from all the Germans. But Jeanette MacDonald was in there. He had a very wide social circle. And they all kind of got ostracized when he married Vivian. And they all came rushing back as soon as he and Vivian got a divorce. He had much better luck as an artist than he did as a husband. Let's put it that way.
And what do you think could account for that? Because I'm used to stories of Hollywood directors being just terrors as tyrannical in the home as they are on sets. But that obviously does not describe Lubitsch.
I gather he was fairly happy with Lenny up until she began having her affair. Certainly, that's what his stepson said, that basically happy household until everything blew sky high.
Mm-hmm.
And the marriage to Vivian, they had a child. The marriage broke up shortly thereafter. He doted on the child, of course, but he never remarried. He preferred the company of actresses, or I don't know if he ever would have remarried. I suspect he would have, because he was a fairly domestic man.
Mm.
You know, he liked his home. He only had one house in Hollywood, still there.
Recently resold, I saw.
Yes. And it looks pretty similar. It hasn't been parted up by any stretch of the imagination. He'd recognize it if he walked in. But he was a fairly gemütlich character. He liked his food. He liked the kind of food he liked. He liked his house. He liked his friends. He was social. He wasn't one of these guys who hold up. He wasn't John Ford holding up on his yacht with two or three friends, you know, and not seeing anybody else. He liked people around him. And he worked a lot. I mean, if you look at his filmography, he made one or two films a year in the 20s and in slowed down in the 30s, but he still made a film every year. So that's a lot of work because his scripts are so precise. They're not something that's slapped together in 3 weeks. And the shooting is very precise as well. And then the editing has to be done under his supervision too, or else you'll kill the jokes.
Oh, yeah. I find that was one of the most incredible things back when I was first learning about Lubitsch years ago, that the fact that he supervised the editing of his film so closely. That's so unusual in that era. And I mean, you can absolutely see it. There's a consistency and a rhythm to his edits that is unmistakable.
Oh, it's totally rhythm oriented. And the beats, it's totally rhythm oriented. It's like music. A movie like Trouble in Paradise, I mean, it actually plays with recitatives and things like that. But the dialogue, the way the dialogue is cut and the way the scenes are cut is very musical. Very musical and absolutely rhythmic. Absolutely. As is to be or not to be.
It really feels like even something as fast as The Merry Widow or something like The Oyster Princess still feels of a piece with something like Clooney Brown and To Be or Not to Be on the other end of that spectrum of speed. And he really knew how to let his jokes breathe, but he also knew just how to pace a scene for energy. It's remarkable to me.
I think Lubitsch begins in the theater and you can always tell he's got that theatrical background because his scenes, as scenes, often play in a theatrical sense. The meet cute, the this, the that, the way the scenes proceed, there's a certain theatrical rhythm to them. And there's certainly sometimes a theatrical rhythm to the actors, you know, the dialogue, the way they get the jokes, the way they put things across. And that comes from both performance and it comes to the cutting. But he's also, at the same time, a very fluid filmmaker at his best. Sometimes the filmmaking isn't as slick as it is other times. That uncertain feeling, for instance. But when he's on with a film like To Be or Not to Be or Shop Around the Corner, you get this perfect meld of cinema and theater because it has the intimacy of cinema, but yet at the same time, you know that you're looking at what is essentially a play. It could be done on stage. It was done on stage, in fact, in Budapest. You can tell that this is a theater piece.
Yeah, he doesn't feel the need to take advantage of tools just because they're there.
No, the intimacy of the theater piece is what he's emphasizing because it's a very intimate story about people's hopes and dreams and how perilous a business it is to bring those hopes and dreams to fruition.
Lubitsch, I mean, we contain multitudes, of course, and we can't reduce even someone like Lubitsch to a single thing, but what can we learn from Lubitsch?
I'll tell you what I think. And this I would not have known had I not written the book. When I started writing the book, it's like 1990. And at this point, there were still a fair number of people alive who knew Lubitsch. So I spent probably 3 to 4 weeks in L.A. driving around, talking to people who knew Lubitsch. Willie Wyler, his wife, Tally. Wyler went out to war. Tally became part of Lubitsch's social circle because he married her, I believe, like about 1940, 41. And then he goes into the war and he's gone for 3 or 4 years. And Lubitsch takes her into his social circle. His doctor, his coronary doctor, to Lupita Tovar, Paul Koner's widow. All these very disparate. I mean, Lupita was a Mexican. Lubitsch's doctor was German, not accidentally, I'm sure. Tally was from the American South. Mary Luce, his closest female friend, platonic, I might add. At the end of his life, young screenwriter who became a novelist, a good novelist, part of his social circle. All these people were alive, and there were half a dozen others, as well as his niece. So I knew the book was going to happen because I figured, well, this is going to be looking for a needle in a haystack trying to find the niece. But I found the niece, and she was like down the road. So at this point, I knew, okay, this is kismet. It's going to work. But anyway, by spending time with all these people, over and over again, Dorschka Rafelson, Sam Rafelson's widow, I was getting a daily dose of Lubitsch transmuted through their own memories of Lubitsch. And all of them, every one of them, lit up at the mere mention of his name. And they all wanted to explain to me and communicate to me what a joy he was as a human being. Forget the movies. If you never saw one of his movies, you would have wanted to be around him at a party, playing the piano, cracking terrible jokes, smoking his horrible black cigar, which probably shortened his life appreciably. And he liked those heavy German food and sausages, which also probably shortened his life appreciably. But the sheer joy that they transmitted to me in talking about him gave me such a sense of, this is why the films delighted audiences of the period and delight audiences even now, those audiences that see them, because of the spirit and the personality of the man it's making. Because he wasn't just being handed a script and turning it over in 6 weeks and going on to the next script that the studio gave him. He was building these films by hand, almost literally by hand, in the same way a sculptor takes clay and molds it until it's as good as he could make it in terms of the figure he had in his head. The figure in your mind matches up to the figure you're sculpting. That's what Lubitsch was doing on film. And at the same time, he was a fully formed, generous, soulful human being who tended people and took care of people and cherished people. And when he died, they all felt a huge, huge gap and void had opened up in their lives. And none of them felt anybody else had ever filled that void. So my task was to communicate that through the vehicle of talking about his career as an artist, his career in the theater, his career as a film director. At the same time, his career as a human being, his life as a human being. Because when you're talking about great artists, you often have to make allowances for the fact that they focus more on the art than they do on their self-awareness. And as a result, they can be pretty dreadful human beings. Lubitsch was not a dreadful human being. Lubitsch was a delightful human being. So I was spending time once removed from a man that was more than a great artist, but he was also a superlative, generous, loving man. And that's not often the case when you write about history. So I just felt lucky. People ask me, what's your favorite book? I always say, I have no idea what my favorite book is. I can tell you what books I enjoy writing the most. That I can tell you. And Lubitsch is one, Hank and Jim is another, because they're essentially relationship books. And Lubitsch started out to be a biography. It kind of segues, I think, into Lubitsch's nurturing personality, nurturing Billy Wilder, teaching him how to be a screenwriter, showing him how to be a director, nurturing Tally Wyler while her husband's away at war, and calming her fears that something terrible might happen to her. Things like that. Things like that. Very human, very ground level emotions. And I love that about him, and I still do. So I developed this dual view of a man I admired unreservedly as an artist, but I also admired him unreservedly as a human being, and still do. And that is unusual. There aren't a lot of subjects that I could say that about, that I've written about, in all honesty.
Well, that's an incredibly touching way to sum it all up. What do you think audiences should know about the upcoming period in Lubitsch's career that we're going to cover this season?
This period is a transitional period in terms of he's at Paramount, then he's not. He goes over to Metro and he tries Independence again, and Metro's a success and Independence isn't. And then he signs up at Fox and he makes Heaven Can Wait, which I adore. And then he has this massive coronary, which completely alters everything that comes after. He becomes something I don't think he ever wanted to be. I don't think he ever would have taken, produced pictures that other people directed. That's not what he was interested in. What he was interested in was on the set, under the lights, working with actors, finding joy. Script writing was fun, but that was also hard work. I think on the set was fun. The set was fun. Writing is work, as I can tell you. Any writer can tell you it's a lot of work, you know? But working with actors, I think, was his joy. And working with his cameraman and working with the crew, that was his joy. Because he was a people person. He was a people person. So it's a transitional time. And there's before the heart attack that came right after at the wrap party for Heaven Can Wait. Everything that happens before is kind of a piece. I mean, there are transitions because he burns out at Paramount and reconstitutes himself at Metro and at UA, where he does the two pictures, To Be or Not to Be and Uncertain Feeling. But after the heart attack, everything changes and everything gets darker because he has a harder time functioning as a professional. And that was his identity. It was much harder for him, much more stressful for him, much more damaging for him, for his idea of himself, and much less satisfying for him because of the physical constraints and because he grew afraid. And I don't think he'd ever been afraid. He was not a fearful personality, but he became a somewhat fearful personality because he didn't know when the next angina attack would kill him.
How did he deal with that? And how maybe did that also impact? I mean, his one completed film in that period is Clooney Brown.
Which is lovely. It's a nice film. I find it a little short on energy. I'm not sure anybody else agrees. It's a lovely film, but it doesn't quite have the snap that Lubitsch at his best has, I think. It might be because he was just pulling back a little bit for fear of strain, you know, physical strain, emotional strain. And I like it. I give Daryl Zanuck a great deal of credit because work for Lubitsch was his life. And because the doctors didn't want him directing, Zanuck let him produce Dragonwyck. And although he took his name off the picture, which tells me he didn't like the picture, because the posters, the original one sheets, had his name on it, produced by Ernst Lubitsch. I had a poster of Dragonwyck, the most beautiful 20th Century Fox lithos, and it had a snipe over his credit. So after the posters were printed, he had his name taken off the picture. He produced that, and he produced the remake of Forbidden Paradise, the one with Tallulah Bankhead. And again, his name's not in the picture. That was a way of keeping him on the payroll, you know, and keeping him functioning. Not the way he wanted to function, but functioning in after a fashion. And Zanuck understood how important work was to Lubitsch's personality. Because as I said, his personal life had not been given him the equivalent satisfaction that his work had, which is not unusual, let's face it, amongst the writers or directors or actors, the percentage of multiple marriages ad infinitum is very high because so much of the emotional intensity goes into the work and there's not a lot left.
I think to be as accomplished as someone like Lubitsch in your field, that often comes with it a certain maniacal focus on the one thing.
Absolutely. It has to.
I've got an entirely unrelated question now that we've exhausted my material. Fritz Lang's Flight from Germany in 1933. The apocryphal one about how he was offered
Goebbels
to head up UFA. Yeah, Goebbels offered him to head up UFA. He leaves the train that night.
Wasn't that night. It was like a month later.
Yeah.
And he went back and forth for a while because he had a lot of stuff to get out of Berlin. I think it's emotionally true. You know, I don't know if Goebbels actually offered, although it's entirely possible, because Hitler was a huge fan of Siegfried and Kriemhild's Revenge, as he would be, of course. It is certainly as conceivable that he was offered basically the Reichsmarshal's job. But like any film director, he compressed and dramatized it.
We can make the future biopic easier, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he was a fascinating man. Very, again, a devoted American. Very, and this was in, I met him in 72. He died in 76, I think. And I would see him a couple of times. I would go to LA twice a year in that era, and we would go out to lunch and he drank Tanqueray. He introduced me to Tanqueray gin, for which I will always be grateful. But he was fierce. He was single-minded. He was funny and dark and bleak. We'd go into a restaurant, and the waitress would come over, and he'd say, "Coffee as black as my soul."
Oh, my gosh.
And he wasn't kidding. Like Lubitsch, he hated Germany. The marriage to Thea von Harbou, it was a bad marriage because she became a Nazi,
mm-hmm.
and he was left-wing, and you can imagine where that went. And he was left-wing when I knew him. He would rail about Vietnam. Richard Nixon hated Nixon and thought he should be wearing an orange jumpsuit picking up trash by the side of the freeway.
I always wonder what Lubitsch would have done in the 60s and, you know, in the free unit or something at MGM.
Yeah.
What would he have done with a large budget Technicolor musical with a stare or something? I don't know.
Well, Mamoulian stuff isn't that good.
Yeah. Silk Stockings is not a great remake.
No. And Summer Holiday is not great either. And those should have been good.
Mm-hmm.
They should have been good. But there's something off about them. And I'm not sure what exactly it is.
Do you have a certain Lubitsch quote that you use the most in your day-to-day life? What comes to your mind?
The saddest. Frank Morgan, when he says of his wife, "She didn't want to grow old with me."
22 years we've been married. 22 years I was proud of my wife. Well, she just didn't want to grow old with me.
That's not a line that anybody under the age of 60 will understand completely. But when you're of a certain age, that's a piercingly sad emotional line.
Mm.
And Morgan delivers it so beautifully. That's the essence of Lubitsch to me. There are a lot of funny lines you could quote in Lubitsch. But to me, there's that light, dark thing that he does so well. And that's the sadness that underlines so much of that Berlin sensibility that he brought to movies. He didn't emphasize it so much in his work, but it does peek through. It does peek through. Or Felix Bressart, where he does the speech from Merchant of Venice.
If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? If you wrong us, shall we not revenge?
And it's played straight. He doesn't play it for laughs. He plays it for passion and for commitment. And this little one-line actor finally getting a chance to say the speech that he's always wanted to say. There's moments of Lubitsch that are so moving to me on a human, emotional level of sadness and of frustration and of stifling. Lives that are essentially stifled and they keep trying to break through, and ultimately they do. That's the whole point of Shop Around the Corner. This little leather goods store full of disparate people who, some of whom get along, most of whom don't. But it's a family. It's a family atmosphere, just like you don't always get along with your family, but you put up with them. That sense of emotional reality that Lubitsch brought to sometimes artificial material, but he always tried to make it emotionally real by these little tiny moments. And if you pick up on those moments, then they become transcendent.
Oh, that's lovely. The final version of the Merchant of Venice speech, it was the first film I ever taught in class, because I think that scene moved me so much. It's bizarrely one of the most artificial scenes you can imagine. There's so many levels of fakery in that, of forgery. I mean, as an actor playing an actor, pretending to be a revolutionary, talking to an actor playing Hitler, right? You know, it's among the most sincere things I've ever seen in cinema or in art.
I agree. That's why he's a great director. That's why he's an artist. He didn't do just one thing. He was able to integrate moments of profound loss and sadness with an essentially benevolent view of human being.
I think that's important. I mean, I'm all for misanthropy, but it's almost rare to find someone who is so successfully humanistic as Lubitsch. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. And anytime you need me to blabble about anything, give me a call. You ask good questions.
Next week, Imogen Sarah Smith joins us to discuss Desire. Head over to ErnstCast.com for information as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing this season and other resources such as show notes and our Discord server. How Would Lubitsch Do It is a production of Moving Image Agency. Sophia Yoon was our dialogue editor for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you happen to use. It helps other people find our podcast and therefore find Ernst Lubitsch. We'd like to acknowledge that this podcast was produced on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples.